Earlier this week, offshore wind farms got a major boost with the news that Google and Good Energies would make a significant investment in the technology. On today's second backstory segment, we look at another way to harness the energy of the oceans, tidal power. And joining us are Paul Jacobson, ocean energy leader for EPRI, E-P-R-I, a nonprofit electricity research company, and Michael Peterson, professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Maine, Orono. He is the leader of the university's Tidal Power Initiative, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to today's show. Paul, can we install a tidal power turbine anywhere along the coast and generate power, or are there certain factors that make a site a good candidate for tidal power generation?
This type of generation is pretty site-specific, and it's important to identify the sweet spots where power can be generated economically and in an environmentally sound way.
The kind of tidal waves that we see in Hawaii, or is there something else that determines what a sweet spot is?
Well, if we're talking about tidal energy here, we're really talking about tidal currents in which there's a constriction that water flows through and generates water velocities, water speeds on the order of a few knots or more. That is used to generate the electricity.
How far offshore do these tend to be? Can they be located in areas where there are also public beaches?
Tidal generation sites tend to be close into shore.
Because you want to be near the grid?
Passages between narrow areas.
Just because of the geology, or because you want to be close to the rest of the grid?
Because it's the constrictions in the surrounding land that produce the higher water velocity.
Places like the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia and the San Francisco Bay have been mentioned as particularly good sites.
That's right.
Because they're structured that way?
Yes, because of the constrictions and the way the water, of course, tides cause large volumes of water to move with on the approximately twice daily cycle, but it's the surrounding land area that then concentrates that flow and produces the higher water velocities that allow for effective electricity generation.
Michael Peterson, people call you Mick, right?
Yes, that's correct.
What do the turbines look like, or does it differ from project to project?
It differs from project to project. We're most extensive, or the project that's furthest along, certainly in Maine, is the one that's being done by Ocean Renewable Power Company. And you mentioned the Bay of Fundy, and they're in the northernmost part of Maine, near Eastport, Maine, where they're working. And if you picture an old-fashioned reel-type mower, that's the design of their turbine. The other turbines that have been used in most other places look a lot more like an underwater windmill, so the modern wind turbine.
Do they make a lot of noise?
No, they'd be quite quiet. I mean, what you're concerned about is it's a challenging ecosystem. We have to understand who's there and what bothers them. There's certainly noise, and the intensity of the noise depends on who's using the area. And certainly with the whales in Maine or Alaska, where so much of the resource is, we have to be aware of the impact on the whales in the area.
So it's environmental concerns that are what hold this up. Is this an efficient way to produce electricity?
I believe it is. It's going to be part of the mix. We kind of have an old-fashioned view that I kind of picture our old view of electricity sort of as the mainframe, and we're going to probably in the future, it's going to look more like distributed PCs, and this is going to be one of the sources of energy that's going to help spread out our needs for electricity. And the nice thing is, as Paul clearly pointed out, you get this twice a day, so it's nice, reliable energy. And so the people who are operating grids are quite fond of tidal energy because if we don't get the tidal energy when we're supposed to, we've got other bigger problems.
The moon isn't up there anymore. Paul,
yeah, right.
Is that the main advantage of tidal power as opposed to other alternative energies?
That certainly is a very significant one, the predictability.
Because
and,
the wind,
while it does vary,
we can't predict wind.
as opposed to wind, which can vary on a second-by-second or minute-by-minute basis. Tidal power is, while it varies, it's less variable on that time scale, and certainly is very, very predictable.
But I'm assuming, since there are only certain sites that would really be worthwhile, we're still talking about a rather limited source of energy, aren't we?
Well, as Mick pointed out, it's a different environment here, and we're talking about not one magic bullet, but many different technologies which can contribute to the overall renewable energy picture.
How is
for those places where this technology is suitable, it could be very attractive.
How has the uncertainty about its environmental impact affected the permitting process?
It turns out that the environmental review for permitting and licensing is a significant factor. And these are novel devices in environments that have been difficult to study, and relatively little is known. And so there are many unanswered questions, and as a result, the permitting and licensing process is asking questions that haven't been answered.
Mick, you mentioned whales, but what about fishermen? Have they been objecting to this?
Well, as an engineer, I have kind of a funny perspective on this. I figure the technological problems we can overcome, and really we focused in Maine, the vast majority of our effort has gone into the environmental assessment and the resource assessment, basically how much energy is in these locations and what's the environmental impact. When I look at Maine, we have the big sites, such as the Bay of Fundy, which are commercial-scale sites. You have to talk to the people in the area. You have to discuss the implications for energy, jobs, effect on fishermen, certainly in Maine. We've got a second type of sites, which are the small ones. They're very small, and they might be in a fragile ecosystem. And one of our goals with our group is to help communities identify those sites and help make it clear that that is not a good site. You know, I mean, if you're going to impact Atlantic salmon or the endangered eels, you know, we don't want to do it for a small amount of energy. And then most of our effort will probably in the long run go into the medium-sized sites where there's going to be a trade-off. I like to tell people it's not like the old days, the environmental movement, where there was a pipe going into the river and you wanted to stop the nasty stuff coming out of the pipe. We live in a gray world, and there are costs to these developments, and there's going to be impacts, but there's also the benefit, which we all share, of having a low-carbon source of electricity.
My guest is Michael Peterson, professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Maine, Orono. He's the leader of the university's Tidal Power Initiative, and Paul Jacobson, ocean energy leader for EPRI, a nonprofit electricity research company. Is most of the research, Paul, trying to iron out the technical problems? Is that where most of the money is coming from, going into now?
I would say that the effort now is going into trying to get some of these small prototype devices into the water so that they can be studied both from an engineering performance perspective and an environmental perspective.
And who's putting most of the money into it? Is this something that the federal government is supporting? Or in the case of the Bay of Fundy, Canadian government?
It's a combination of private money and government money.
Mick, you've been working on the Eastport site, which is on the coast of Maine. What are you hoping to learn from the work on that site?
One of the first things we're learning is basically overcoming some of the technical difficulties. Ocean Renewable Power Company is working on their device and the challenges of working in 5-knot currents and cold water and around, you know, a very difficult coastal environment. What has been most interesting is what we're beginning to see about fish behavior. We now are to the point where there was a recent paper at American Fisheries Society where one of the grad students and her advisor could show the behavior of herring schools as they went around these turbines and basically sat in the wake of the turbine and would hang out in the wake of the turbine. This is critical to the overall technology, is understanding the behavior of the fish when they see this. It's not like a hydroelectric dam where they're forced through the turbine. in this case, they've got the opportunity to evade the disturbance in the flow stream. And if they do that, we have to know what they're thinking and how they behave. And so there's some important work that's coming out now.
Is there a big difference in installing a tidal power turbine in a place like Eastport and installing one in a heavily trafficked area like New York Harbor or the Hudson and East Rivers? Because there's been talk about doing this in the East River, hasn't there?
Yes, there was a prototype in the East River that was tested, and there's a different set of issues. I mean, certainly when we talk Eastport, the discussion is, you know, what are the lobstermen and the different fishing portions of the community, what is their reaction? Because they're losing bottom space just like it was an aquaculture facility. But by the same token, there's the potential for that to actually function as a marine sanctuary underneath there. So, you know, we have to look at the long-term ecological impact of not fishing certain areas that have these tidal turbines in it.
Paul, does the fact that the East River is part of a tidal estuary make it a particularly good site for tidal power generation?
Yes, the currents there are certainly favorable to power generation, and so yes, that makes it an attractive site. It is also a route for migratory fish species, and so that is a consideration. Those two things go together.
Are any other countries developing tidal power?
Yes. There is quite a bit of development in the UK.
But they have they're a small country with a large shoreline, so I would assume this would be appealing to them. Are they further along in the development process?
They, in some respects, they are. They have been supporting this sort of research and development for a longer period of time. And there are test sites that have been established where devices can be readily brought in to be tested. And so there has been further development there, but I think we're starting to catch up with some of the exciting things that are going on here in the U.S.
But it sounds to me like we're not really generating much electricity from any of these things. We're still in the testing phase?
That's correct. This is still a pre-commercial technology.
And what is the fantasy for the future?
The fantasy for the future. Well, there certainly is the potential to generate a substantial amount of electricity. And I would say that let me see if I can find my numbers here. But there's. We're talking about displacing, potentially large numbers of conventional power plants. I'd say that some of the global estimates for the tidal resource range from, 11 gigawatts up to 400 gigawatts of power, and that is actual annual average power available to be extracted. So that's substantial.
And it doesn't pollute.
And it doesn't pollute.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Paul Jacobson, Ocean Energy Leader for Electric Power Research Institute, EPRI, a nonprofit electricity research group. And Michael Peterson, Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Maine, Orono, who is the leader of the university's Tidal Power Initiative. It's been a pleasure talking with you on today's Backstory.
Thank you.
Thank you.